put those arms up now.
After you move along, you come across a police checkpoint, and Elizabeth suggests that you bypass it through a side door that she proceeds to lockpick. Behind the door, we see a series of posters telling black servants how to properly interact with white patrons. Then we encounter an overly apologetic black man scrubbing the floor. Further ahead, we get the game's ultimate manifestation of the Irish weren't really white trope, with colored and Irish washrooms. Now, even if no Irish need apply signs were a ubiquitous occurrence, at no point in American history were there Irish colored bathrooms. Consider that 8 signers of the Declaration of Independence were Irish, a strange fact considering that racist Anglos supposedly thought of them as Negroes. Granted, most of these men were Protestants of Scots-Irish or Ulster descent, but Charles Carroll was definitely born to a family from Kings County in the Midlands and was a practicing Roman Catholic. There are 2 papers you can read if interested in the ever-growing debate over the supposed no Irish need apply phenomenon. One by Richard Jensen, who posits that it's largely a victimization myth, and a rebuttal by Rebecca Freed, who asserts it was historically widespread. Personally, I found Jensen's response to Freed's paper most convincing. Quote, "The main theme of Rebecca Freed's paper deals with newspaper help wanted ads for adult men carrying the NINA restriction. Her appendix lists 69 citations from 22 cities from 1842 to 1932. Over a third of her 69 citations are faulty. There's no actual job being advertised. But let's not quibble. Let's say that there were 69 newspaper stories from 22 cities over a 90-year period. Is that a lot or a little? The Library of Congress in Chronicling America has a large collection of online newspapers and offers an excellent search engine. It allowed me to search 9,458,697 pages of newspapers from every state from 1836 to 1932. The term, no Irish need apply, appeared on 230 pages. That is one NINA per 41,125 pages, unquote. To be clear, Jensen never denied that there was discrimination against the Irish. Rather, he only denied the absurd levels to which pop culture had taken the mythology of Irish victimhood, which Ken Levine and Irrational Games definitely took to an even higher level with their Irish colored bathrooms. Now, the more astute viewer may note that Freed is a peculiar surname for someone so interested in Irish Americans. Freed is almost exclusively an Ashkenazi surname and is Yiddish in origin. Rebecca Freed was also only 14 at the time she had her paper published in the Oxford Journal of Social History. To be sure, it's exceedingly well written, although, again, not convincing. Still, color me impressed. Though it does seem likely that her father, who is a lawyer, who gave her Jensen's original paper to read, probably assisted her a great deal in the writing. The historian Kirby Miller also worked with the duo, so color me not so impressed. But what's my opinion compared to all the media outlets who ran stories about a 14-year-old girl who had outwitted a college professor? Now, I'm sure Rebecca is indeed a very gifted and talented young woman, since she was admitted to Sidwell Friends School, but I find all the elements of this story, when combined, to be fairly suspect. For example, why is a 14-year-old Jewish girl reading papers on 19th century discrimination against the Irish? The answer is that her father gave her the paper to read. But why is a Jewish lawyer handing his 14-year-old daughter papers on 19th century discrimination against the Irish? Perhaps one motivation for Rebecca and her father to write their paper was to defend the work of the late Noel Ignatieff, a co-ethnic who not only shared Rebecca's particular interest in the Irish-American experience, but also made it his life's work to abolish the white race. Now, what's interesting about anti-Irish sentiments in America is that they were probably most prominent around 1845, when the Irish were immigrating en masse to America during the potato famine. But anti-Irish sentiments were always more pronounced in England, especially during the 1830s and 40s. Now, curiously, Benjamin Disraeli, England's first Jewish prime minister, made some exceedingly racist public statements about the Irish during this period. In 1836, he stated, quote, "The Irish hate our free and fertile isle. They hate our order, our civilization, our enterprising industry, our sustained courage, our decorous liberty, our pure religion. This wild, reckless, indolent, uncertain, and superstitious race have no sympathy with the English character. Their fair ideal of human felicity is an alternation of clannish broils and coarse idolatry. Their history describes an unbroken circle of bigotry and blood. My lords, shall the delegates of these tribes, under the direction of the Roman priesthood, ride roughshod over our country, over England, haughty and still imperial England? Unquote. Disraeli also had very public feuds with Irishmen, such as Daniel O'Connell, wherein he referred to the common Irish folk as public beggars swarming with obtrusive boxes in the chapels, and as, quote, a starving race of fanatical slaves. Now, his comments may or may not have been wholly representative of Jewish attitudes at the time, but it is noteworthy that the second most prominent Jew in Anglo politics, Louis Charles Levin, also had extreme anti-Irish Catholic sentiments, albeit on the other side of the Atlantic, in America. As previously mentioned, Louis Levin was the first president of the Know-Nothing Party, which was the follow-up to the American Republican Party, of which he was also a member. Curiously, Levin married two Christian women, and considering an assortment of things he said later in life, it does seem plausible that he had converted to Protestantism at this point, though the evidence is somewhat circumstantial. In addition to being well known for his oratory talents, Levin was also a notorious alcoholic with large amounts of debt. He filed for bankruptcy in 1841 after exhausting the money of his second wife's late husband. As an aside, he met his second wife while picking out the tombstone of his first. Levin was also charged with attempted murder once, got himself shot in a duel, and even stabbed a fellow congressman. He never stayed in one place for too much time, it seems, since wherever he went, trouble followed, as well as creditors. Although a lawyer by profession, in 1844 he was the editor of a local Philadelphia paper called The Daily Sun, which he used to spread his anti-Catholic talking points. But Levin wasn't just a man of words. That summer, he organized 3,000 nativist Protestants to march into a Catholic neighborhood in Kensington and started a riot that ultimately left several people dead, many more homeless, and three Catholic churches burnt to the ground. Levin was later indicted for inciting this riot, but the case never went to trial. In fact, Levin went on to become a congressman after this whole affair. Later, he even campaigned for a seat in the Senate, which, prior to the 17th Amendment, was elected by the state legislature. But he failed in these endeavors, and in 1855, he was accused of bribing government officials to gain said Senate seat. Now, all this said, it's quite fascinating that Noel Ignatieff wrote an entire book about how Irish Catholics supposedly were not considered white and discriminated against, yet felt no need to mention either Benjamin Disraeli or Louis Levin. Well, technically, he does bring them both up, although very briefly. On page 163, Ignatieff states that Levin was arrested for inciting to treason in his newspaper, though that's the full extent of his efforts. Disraeli is a mere footnote in his bibliography. Now, perhaps this is because, as Zachary Schrag states in his article on Louis Levin in Tablet magazine, that Levin is seen as a Shandafar di Goyim. This Yiddish term isn't quite as easy to translate as it may seem, but in essence, it's a Jew who makes other Jews look bad to Gentiles, or a Jew who brings shame to the Jewish people, or a Jew who in some fashion betrays or undermines Jewish interests. Zachary Schrag's book on the Philadelphia riots of 1844 is an exceptionally well-written and scholarly work. It surprisingly gives great focus and prominence to Louis Levin's role in the nativist movements at that time period. But, unsurprisingly, it still generally views 19th century sectarian conflicts in America through a 20th century neoliberal lens of egalitarianism, and draws anachronistic conclusions in the process. Let me quote a paragraph to give you an idea. Quote, "The eruption of 1844 altered the landscape of both Philadelphia and the United States. But it may be even more important for the underground currents it revealed. Levin and the nativists championed a vision of American citizenship limited to white, male, native-born Protestant men. In the tumultuous 1840s, believers in this vision faced challenges from abolitionists, American Indians, early feminists, Mormons, and, not least, from Irish Catholic immigrants, who, even in these years before the Great Hunger, were already crossing the Atlantic by the tens of thousands. As these immigrants sought homes, jobs, votes, and the right to practice their faith, they presented an alternative vision of America, defined not by birthright, but by a willingness to embrace shared values of freedom and democracy. Unquote. Here, Schrage is drawing a straight line from America's post-1965 pluralist identity, wherein men like Dennis Prager reinterpret e pluribus unum to denote multiculturalism, to a time where not even the quote-unquote persecuted Irish Catholic immigrants would have believed in such pluralism. No Irishman wanted to embrace women's suffrage or share full political rights with Negroes at the time. Neither did the suffragettes, for that matter. Now, to the extent that American Indians interacted with us peacefully, it was for trade. Most of them would have driven us into the sea if they could. Schrage, although a very respectable scholar, still seeks to interpret 19th century sectarian unrest as being part of some ahistorical pluralist anti-racist American tradition that, in reality, never really actually quite existed. Now, there's much, much more that could and probably should be said here, but in the interest of time, we'll move on. Getting back to Columbia's colored bathrooms, in a nearby linen closet is a recording of Daisy Fitzroy.
When I first seen Columbia, that sky was the brightest, bluest sky that ever was. Seemed like heaven. Then your eyes adjusted to the light, and you saw that sea of white faces looking hard back at you.
So Columbia would indeed be heaven for Daisy Fitzroy if it weren't full of white people. Even if we take the perspective that she's only upset by the sea of white faces looking hard back at her, this kind of suggests that most Colombians don't really appreciate the importation of Negro convicts. So, again, why are Negro convicts being imported into a white ethnostate? Up ahead is an arcade where we're greeted by a representative of Mr. Fink, the same man who ran the racist raffle earlier.
Mr. DeWitt! Mr. DeWitt! There's no cause for anxiety. Mr. Fink sends this with his regards.
So, what was it that
caught Mr. Fink's attention? Your savagery, Mr. DeWitt.
Again, Ken wants to signal that DeWitt, and by extension the player, are the real savages. Here in the arcade, we're introduced to the Duke and Dimwit series, which is focused on instilling a sense of patriotism in children via propaganda.
Hey, Wallace Flintlock! It's the newest one in the series. I read it was delayed 3 times.
Are you a Duke? Or a Dimwit?
Now, what's most interesting here isn't necessarily the joke that Irrational Games was making about development cycles, or even the caricatured nature of Columbia's patriotism propaganda. It was that Ken Levine was telling the audience that Colombians are really bad people because they use a spoonful of sugar to make their medicine go down. This is exactly what Ken Levine was doing, however, with his video games. He was using the appeal of video games to insert his own anti-white propaganda. Moving on to the whites-only bathroom, Elizabeth asks why it's there.
Why is one bathroom for colors and the other for whites?
It just is.
Seems like an unnecessary complication.
This is just virtue signaling. It's impossible that someone would have no knowledge of segregation in 1912. Yes, Elizabeth was locked in a tower her whole life, but seconds prior, she told us she knew all about the Duke and Dimwit series. The implication being that she was subjected to the same racist Colombian propaganda as every other child. Moreover, the racist Colombian scientists who kept her locked up probably heavily curated her library. I doubt she had many books on abolition and egalitarianism. This game truly is narrative Legos. We'll ignore the mother in the corner scolding her son for kissing an Irish girl and focus on the film about how Mr. Fink, Colombia's uber-capitalist, will solve the quote-unquote Irish problem.
Thank you.
I don't know what this is based on. The Irish never really had a reputation for being lazy. A scholar David Doyle notes, by 1900, the Irish, quote, had attained class structure parity with native stock Protestant white America, a point with vital implications for Irish American labor. In the 1890s, there were 36 Irish American congressmen, four senators, the first Irish Catholics in the cabinet and on the Supreme Court, the first important Irish appointments to the diplomatic service, unquote. Doyle goes on to highlight that, quote, while the Irish Americans in 1900 were only 7.5% or 1/13th of the total American workforce, yet they provided 1/6 of the Teamsters, of iron and steel workers, of other metal workers, and of masons, 1/5 of stonecutters, leather tanners, wire workers, brass workers, skilled textile workers, paper mill workers, roofers, and street rail workers, and, their industrial triumph, almost 1/3 of plumbers, steam fitters, and boil makers. In addition, they exceeded their proportion in almost every other skilled and semi-skilled urban employment, if to less spectacular degree, e.g. around 1/10 of electricians, miners, glassblowers, blacksmiths, 1/8 of machinists, railroad men, printers, and so on, unquote. The extent to which there was anti-Irish sentiment in America certainly was never because Americans felt that the Irish were lazy. Yes, the Irish did have a bit of a reputation for drinking, but anti-Irish feelings, again to the extent that they existed, were because the Irish were Catholic immigrants who were collectivizing as an ethnic bloc to corner urban job markets, which detracted from local native-born Protestants. Yes, at times the Irish were depicted as ape-like in various cartoons, but this really doesn't mean what people think it does. Germans were often depicted in equally disparaging ways. For example, here's an anti-German propaganda poster from World War I. Here's another from World War II. Now, do these posters mean that Anglos seriously thought that Germans weren't actually white? Now, there's a whole nuanced discussion that can and should take place surrounding the Irish experience in America. But again, the Irish were never seen as alien in the same sense that Negroes, Mexicans, and East Asians were. The only conclusion people should draw here from nativist backlash toward mass Irish immigration into America is that even mass immigration from whites will carry with it certain problems. But that does not mean non-white groups are ever going to assimilate like the Irish have. We'll talk more about this again later. For now, though, we're going to skip ahead to where DeWitt and Elizabeth attempt to buy tickets to the First Lady's aerodrome. DeWitt and Elizabeth are ambushed at the ticket booth by some of Comstock's men. DeWitt responds in self-defense and kills them all, which upsets Elizabeth, who had yet to see any real violence in her life. She then flees, and DeWitt catches up to her at a nearby gondola station. As they ride upward, she expresses her disapproval.
Kill those people. I can't believe you did that. They're all dead. You killed those people.
Elizabeth,
you're a monster.
What did you think was going to happen?
What?
Do you understand the expense the people went through to keep you locked up in that tower? You think people like that are just going to let you walk away? You are an investment, and you will not be safe until you are far away from here.
What do they want from me?
I don't know. One thing I've learned. If you don't draw first, you don't get to draw at all.
You're bleeding. Come here. What happened back there? That's not the last of it, is it?
I don't know.
There.
DeWitt's response largely signals Elizabeth's victimhood, which we find out later DeWitt is largely responsible for since he's the one who sold her to Comstock. From here, we arrive at Soldier's Station, a patriotic amusement park marketed to children. When we enter, there's a song playing over some loudspeakers.
Marching into town, you be prepared to stand those buggers down. They'll do their level best to take all that's rightly yours, and it's yours on duty to keep them from our shore. Readiness is all.
Every boy must attend.
Oh, the readiness is all.
To be down and
sights on all the fields with wankers in your town. Pop your pistols, load the cannon, make sure fair bets are fixed. Or else we'll rule the day when the race is intermixed. The readiness is full.
If you glance around, you'll notice that many of the posters adorning the hall have anti-Semitic themes, and if you explore the right side of the room, Elizabeth will comment on one of the displays.
Soldiers Field, built in 1903 by the hand of our prophet.
What interest is a prophet having a bunch of carnies and carousels?
The place is themed to acquaint children with national service.
You mean the military?
Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it.
Did you write that?
No.
The aim here is to show that Colombian patriotism is evil for teaching its children to hate others. Yet this game is teaching young white men to hate themselves and their heritage. The best part, though, is that the lines here are from the Old Testament, Proverbs 22:6. This really captured my attention because Ken discusses Jewish chosenness by God in an interview right before this game released.
This notion of him being, you know, sort of a mosaic figure, leading people out of Egypt, you know, to a better place, and what he would call the Sodom below. And like, why? Who were the chosen people in his views? You know, who were? Because if you look at it, like, I'm of Jewish descent. You know, the notion of the chosen people is incredibly racist, right? You know, like, it's we're better than everybody else. So, you know, just if you flip that on its head and you put that in the context of a white sort of Protestant, well, at least originally a Protestant, you know, then your sort of back gets up. But, you know, in 2 weeks it'll be Passover and everybody will be talking about the chosen. So I think it's people, that's a pretty common sort of meme. That's why we tend to lean on existing memes like the story of Moses, like the story of Noah. Those play heavily into sort of Comstock's frame of mind. But you just write the story you want to write.
I think Ken is inadvertently admitting here that this concept is central to Judaism, but not Christianity. Detractors might claim here that Ken is actually enthusiastically condemning Jewish racism. But ask yourselves, why didn't he explore that in a game? Why did he have to, quote-unquote, flip that on its head? And how does flipping that on its head equal a genocidal Protestant ethnostate? The opposite of Jewish chosenness is simply unchosenness. Ken's perspective here is highly revealing of his own attitude that Christianity is the antithesis of Judaism. Back in Soldier's Field, there's a nearby kinetoscope wherein Rosalind Lutess's female genius is highlighted. The film, oddly enough, states that quantum mechanics are a kind of, quote, female intuition. It's technically not Rosalind saying this either, but rather Colombian propagandists. In other words, despite Bioshock's narrative about an oppressive patriarchy, Colombian misogynists proudly boasted that a woman was responsible for their floating city. So the developers' desire to signal pro-feminist stances simply overtook their ability to maintain a consistent depiction of their villains. On the other side of this room is another recording of Daisy Fitzroy.
Days at Comstock House was simple. Hard work, sure, but simple. Wringing the linen, scrubbing the floors. Lady Comstock, she even had a kind word now and then. Almost enough to make me think I had a place in their world. God made foolish girls so he could have something to play with.
This is just more signaling of white oppression. Black people simply wanted to have a place in the white man's world, but were denied it because the white man is irrationally wicked. Curiously, though, the posturing here unintentionally implies that it is indeed our world and not theirs. It's also pretty clear, looking at the carefully placed propaganda here, that what Ken means to convey to the young white male gamer is that the most evil thing he can do is seek to protect his people. And once again, at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I have to highlight that Columbia is a city built on quantum mechanics, and so its importation of Daisy Fitzroy to do menial house chores is a very ham-fisted way to get the desired oppression narrative. Oddly enough, though, the idea of house chores being oppressive potentially reveals a very posh mindset. Past the Welcome Center, DeWitt and Elizabeth can explore a local ice cream shop, where its attendant reminds us once again not to accept any foreign substitutes. The meta-narrative being that supporting your nation's domestic businesses and products leads to racism. On the walls are more Duke and Dimwit posters, one reiterating the need to repel the foreign hordes, which again is pretty bizarre, since the xenophobic ethnostate built on quantum mechanics keeps importing the foreign hordes. After this, Elizabeth asks DeWitt about his past.
What are you, Mr. DeWitt? Some sort of...
I'm a, independent contractor. Used to work for the Pinkertons and such. Not something you'd want gracing a resume.
Pinkertons? Weren't they the ones they'd call in to settle things when the workers took to striking?
Settle? Oh, that's a word for it.
The Pinkertons are another historical meme here, being lathered on top of DeWitt in order to undermine his morality. He broke up strikes, he sold his own child, he was a drunken gambling addict, and he massacred women and children at Wounded Knee. Note here that DeWitt is himself implying to the player that he knows that he is a bad man. And as the game progresses, this really does become more and more of a trend. Now, perhaps what's a little more interesting about the Pinkertons' inclusion here is that the game never goes into any real detail about who and what they were. There's just this general assumption that the audience already knows that the Pinkertons were evil capitalist men who broke up strikes using violence. Which is technically true in a sense, but African Americans were also notorious strike breakers as well. And Alan Pinkerton was not only a staunch abolitionist, but his agency gained much of its notoriety for having thwarted secessionists from assassinating Abraham Lincoln in 1861 in what was known as the Baltimore Plot. What's more, Kate Warren, the agency's female detective, played quite a leading role in the affair, though the Canadian television series The Pinkertons really does embellish her role in the agency. Regardless, the two people did quite extensive intelligence work for the Union Army during the Civil War. To be clear, my goal here isn't to defend the Pinkertons. To this day, they still engage in some very questionable activities, and I'm no fan of union busting. The point here is to highlight that Irrational Games had a very, very specific narrative they wanted to craft.
Lego, a whole new world to build.
Finally arriving at the gondola station to the First Lady airship, DeWitt and Elizabeth discover that they have yet another obstacle. They need a new vigor called Shock Jockey in order to power the gondola. This, of course, can only be found in the nearby Hall of Heroes. On the way over, they are, of course, attacked by more Colombian patriots. Afterwards, on the elevator ride up, Elizabeth displays her miraculous ability to open interdimensional portals.
What are you doing?
Opening a tear!
Oh, shit! What is that?
It's a tear. I used to open them all the time in my tower.
What is a tear?
It's like a window. A window to another world. Most of the time they're dull as dishwater, a different colored towel or tea instead of coffee. But sometimes I see something amazing and I pull it through. There.
Good God. I don't suppose you've got an airship in there?
I don't think so. But there is. There is something. Oh, no!
Close it.
I'm trying!
Close it!
The scene reiterates the idea that Elizabeth has access to a world of possibilities, yet she's held back by a giant mechanical bald eagle and oppressive white men who seek to hold her within a cage. Upon exiting the elevator, we see that much has been vandalized with red paint. On one poster is written, "A righteous wind is coming." Nearby, we find another recording.
I served 20 years of soldiering, and every heathen land I've known is less peopled for my passing. I hated no special enemy. Until now. Comstock. He's made a vaudeville travesty of my battles and cast himself as the White Knight. I called him out over it, and he stripped me of my rank. That man has never seen the savage face of war.
Cornelius Slate has apparently killed lots and lots of brown people, but as we progress forward, we find out that he is the one responsible for all this vandalism of Columbia's property. He's angry at Comstock for something along the lines of stolen valor, and herein enters the insertion of yet another long-established trope, that nationalist leaders are all cowards, stealing other people's glory, or fabricating self-aggrandizing tales so that they can make up for some internal deficiency. When we reach an opening ahead, we can hear a Columbia military officer explaining to his men how Slate is in fact a traitor.
We will teach Cornelius Slate a lesson! Now, I know you've all come to think of Slate as some kind of war hero, but let me be abundantly clear. Cornelius Slate is no hero! He's been living down in Finkton so long that the man has gone native! If Slate had his way, the damn collards and potato eaters would be up at Comstock House running Columbia! Or in your homes, copulating with your wives! Now, he has holed himself up in the Hall of Heroes! And it is our job to get him out, alive or dead.
Once again, we hear the term going native, though the usage here is out of its typical historical context. Circa 1912, going native would have described adopting the lifestyles of colonial subjects or indigenous peoples adjacent to colonial expansion. But Finkton is an industrial center that's supposed to be reminiscent of 19th century company and shanty towns, where recently arrived immigrants or ex-slaves resided. Regardless, the point here is that Slate has joined forces with the Vox Populi and has adopted their customs, which, per the soldiers, are to copulate with everyone's wives. The cartoonishly evil and unhinged rhetoric is probably meant to motivate us to kill them, which is what we have to do to progress. Afterwards, Elizabeth asks who Slate is. DeWitt replies that he actually knows him, but doesn't say much else, just that the man has a knack for making enemies. Nearby is a bar full of dead Vox Populi. Daisy Fitzroy is yelling on the radio about how soon Comstock's idols of gold will melt and run in rivulets throughout the city streets. There's a dead cop in the kitchen that Slate killed, and in the nearby recording of the killing, Slate babbles on about some sense of military honor that Comstock lacks. But of more interest is the coded Vox Populi message on the bathroom wall. Elizabeth tells you that there's probably a code book nearby that can decrypt it. If you find it, you'll gain access to a hidden cache with another Daisy Fitzroy recording.
The one thing people need to learn is that fear is the antidote to fear. I don't want to be a part of their world. I don't want to be a part of their culture, their politics, their people. The sun is setting on their world, and soon enough, all they gonna see is the dark.
So, Daisy Fitzroy no longer wishes to be a part of their world. She wants to destroy it. I suppose the rationale is that if she can't have it, no one can.
And a time to destroy!
Now, there are definitely racial undertones here of genocide. Of course, the diehard fans will assert here that the Irish are part of the Vox Populi movement too. So clearly, this cannot be about race. Please don't tell me this in the comments. That's a cope. This segment here is all about race. On the other side of the street is a souvenir shop. Inside is another one of Columbia's kinetoscope films. It calls the Vox Populi, quote, malcontents who loathe our way of custom and who want what you have. Now, this is probably meant to mock the American nationalist, nativist, and pro-white stances of the early 20th century. Though it is curious that Fitzroy's statements about how the sun is about to set on white America is positioned so closely to this kinetoscope. The game almost appears to be supporting the very position of the caricatured America it's attacking. Yet, I suspect the real message intended here is more along the lines that Daisy Fitzroy's hostility toward white America is a response to white America's hostility toward her, and that the almost back-to-back contrast between her voxophone and this kinetoscope recording is commentary about how one set of immoral behaviors leads into another. but ask yourself whom the game depicts as the prime mover, and point to in the end as the culprit of setting all this in motion. From here, we can go upstairs and listen to another recording, this one from a female soldier in Colombia's army.
God makes all kinds of soldiers, but he only made one Cornelius Slate. My father followed him up San Juan Hill, through the legations in Peking, and as he put it, through hell the order was given. At today's muster, Slate asked me if I was Sergeant Monroe's daughter. I said, yes, sir, I am. Slate said, your father always wanted a son. I hope the fool has wisdom enough to recognize his good fortune.
This is just more very out-of-place virtue signaling of feminist ideals. It's supposed to make Slate, the traitor to Colombia, that is, America, look more appealing to a pre-Gamergate audience who had fully internalized and accepted feminist ideals. Whereas Comstock is depicted as a misogynist, Slate is far more accepting of women and their role in his rebel army. The thing is, though, this woman was already in the army when Slate rebelled against Comstock, which means Colombia's military was already integrated. This is yet another anachronism insofar that the Women's Armed Services Integration Act wasn't passed until 1948. Prior to this, women were barred from serving in any capacity beyond nurses. Taking the sky rails from here up to the Hall of Heroes, we find another one of Slate's recordings in a parked gondola.
Veterans! You shed your heart's blood for Colombia! Lost limb and viscera in the godless Orient! Comstock did nothing! And yet, look up! Whose image squats above you even now? At every angle and insult! If the prophet would make a painted whore of our past, what fresh rape does our future hold? Let us now make our stand and fill yonder hall with true heroes!
Leaving the gondola behind and progressing farther ahead, we see that in response to Comstock making a painted whore of Slate's past, Slate has turned Lady Liberty into a painted whore. Now, this doesn't make much sense. Slate, a very patriotic man who just used the phrase, the godless Orient, has now decided to start trashing his nation's monuments because he felt slighted by his commander-in-chief. Clearly, the developers were more interested in engaging in iconoclasm than they were in fleshing out credible motivations. After killing another large swath of American patriots, we finally enter the Hall of Heroes, and are greeted by an automaton of George Washington.
Too rare is the man who takes a stand for God and sweetest fatherland, but here's the place where we revere the heroes of our city dear.
The room here is adorned with various patriotic paintings. One in particular that stands out is of Stonewall Jackson, the famous Confederate general of the Civil War. Nearby is another one of Slate's recordings.
They'll call us assassins when our work is done. Cornelius Slate, the swift left hook of the Vox Populi. We'll be trading Comstock's life for a new one. So be it. The Fitzroy woman and I are comrades of necessity. I doubt all the men who retten Caesar's toga would still be seen breaking bread together in peacetime. Comstock gone, my men's past deeds will be sacred, and they will claim the spoils to them. I need not live to see it.
Here we learn that Slate's alliance with the Vox Populi is one of necessity. As he states, they're trading one lie for another. Still, none of this makes any sense. If Slate's goal is to eliminate Comstock so that his men's social standing can be restored, he himself says that by killing Comstock, the Colombians will view him and his men as assassins, as traitors who helped a bunch of anarchists burn down their city. If the Colombians crush the attempted coup d'etat, then they'll round up Slate's men and execute them. If Daisy Fitzroy installs a new government, well, I kind of doubt she's going to hold up Slate's men and their glorious deeds of the past for everyone to honor and cherish. So, no matter what happens, Slate's men lose here. Entering the main hall, Elizabeth comments on the exhibit.
Our prophet, Father Comstock, commander of the 7th Cavalry.
That man did not lead the 7th. Hell, I don't even remember the guy.
Corporal DeWitt proved his worth on the field that day.
Well, I'll be.
Slate? Is that you?
You've always been different, haven't you, Booker? You crave no glory.
Look, I see you're caught up in some kind of jam here. If you could see fit to let us through to where they keep the shock jockey, then we'll...
That tin soldier, Comstock, wants my boys dead. We won't die at his hands.
There's going to be trouble.
All my men have left is a choice. Die at the hands of a tin soldier, or a real one!
So now is when the player learns that Booker was not only a Pinkerton agent, but was also part of the Wounded Knee Massacre. The pieces are coming together. DeWitt is a huge, guilt-ridden piece of shit. Of course, players are probably thinking at this point that DeWitt is somehow on a path to redemption by fighting all these evil American patriots. From here, we see that Slate has vandalized not just Comstock's exhibits, but all the other soldiers' exhibits. So again, the message here is not that Comstock's legacy is a lie, but that all of America, Columbia, is a lie. In the next room, we see an exhibition of Columbia's timeline, and off to the right and left, respectively, are exhibits of Wounded Knee and the Boxer Rebellion. First, we'll go to Wounded Knee. Slate speaks to us over the intercom.
The Tin Soldier is taking credit for the deeds of the real ones. Now your companion, young lady, he wrapped himself in glory on December 29, 1890.
What does he mean?
You don't want to know.
Strangely, the game never actually explains the Wounded Knee event. It just sort of assumes that everyone is on board with the basic idea that it was a massacre by the 7th Cavalry, or that, generally speaking, white man bad, Indians good, and that this exhibit must be racist propaganda. There are depictions of Indians killing and scalping white women, which, again, are meant to be mocked as racist propaganda. But this actually happened. And quite a lot. Here's one account of what two Denver men came across in 1864. Quote, "About 100 yards from the desolated ranch, we discovered the body of the murdered woman and her two dead children, one of which was a little girl of 4 years, and the other, an infant. The woman had been stabbed in several places and scalped, and the body bore evidences of having been violated. The two children had their throats cut, their heads being nearly severed from their bodies." Unquote. Up ahead is another George Washington automaton that recites a poem about Wounded Knee.
"With hue and cry, with hatchet red, they danced amongst our noble dead. But when our soldiers took the field, the savage horde could only yield."
Now, this is obviously not exactly how the Battle of Wounded Knee went, but that's the point. This is supposed to be evil patriotic American propaganda covering up a horrible crime against the supremely peaceful Sioux Indians. Inside the next room, Slate addresses us again over the intercom.
You were there. At Wounded Knee. I can see it in your face.
Tell her, Booker! Tell her how we strode that battlefield like the heroes of Sparta. I still hear the screams. Let's come, stop.
There he is!
Here's the soldier I spoke of! No. The kind of man Comstock pretends to be! See if I told you true!
We'll ignore the mischaracterization of the Spartans, and instead focus on the slander against the 7th Cavalry, who most certainly didn't have some sort of bloodlust that enticed them to make war on the Sioux that day. Contrary to popular belief, the Sioux were not a peaceful people. Robert Utley's description of Sioux culture on pages 10 and 11 of his book, The Last Days of the Sioux Nation, are quite helpful in understanding this. Quote, "The highest values of the Tetons centered on war. For a young man, success in battle offered the surest and quickest path to prestige, wealth, and high rank. A collection of enemy scalps was his badge of success, and together with the qualities of bravery, daring, and cleverness, earned him the esteem of men and the admiration of women." Unquote. It should also be stressed here that in the months leading up to the Battle of Wounded Knee, the Sioux Indians had adopted a New Age religion called the Ghost Dance. A Paiute man named Vovoka from Nevada was its originator, and his teachings supposedly were peaceful, instructing Indians not to fight the white man. But, by some accounts, however, this stipulation was subservient to the general idea that supernatural forces were going to destroy the white man and bring back the old ways of the Indian.
The white man, my children, will soon be no more.
Now, Vovoka was probably an opportunistic charlatan, but we won't get into that due to time constraints. The main focus here is that different tribes held different interpretations of Vovoka's ghost dance prophecy. The Sioux spoke of giant floods that would drown all the white people, or crush them in a tremendous landslide, which is exceedingly ironic given Bioshock's extreme focus on an ahistorical genocidal Protestantism. A quote on page 70 of Robert Utley's book stands out insofar that it highlights the almost comical parallel. Quote, Vovoka was but one of a long line of aboriginal mystics who sought to rid their people of an alien oppressor and lead them into the promised land. Unquote. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Ken Levine and Irrational Games had no interest in exploring this Native American xenophobia and desire to repel the foreign hordes. In any event, by 1891, the spiritual leaders of the Sioux had begun pushing the idea that the ghost shirts, worn during the ghost dance, could actually deflect the white man's bullets. One woman who survived the Wounded Knee battle was told that she must remove her ghost shirt so that the whites could treat her injuries. She replied, quote, "Yes, take it off. They told me a bullet would not go through. Now I don't want it anymore." Unquote. As one American official noted in the months leading up to Wounded Knee, quote, "It would seem impossible that any person, no matter how ignorant, could be brought to believe such absurd nonsense. But as a matter of fact, a great many Indians of this agency actually believe it. And since this new doctrine has been engrafted here from the more southern Sioux agencies, the infection has been wonderful and so pernicious that it now includes some of the Indians who were formerly numbered with the progressive and more intelligent, and many of our very best Indians appear dazed and undecided when talking of it, their inherent superstition having been thoroughly aroused." Unquote. Naturally, these new religious activities had the U.S. Army and local white settlers concerned. The Sioux were pulling their children out of school to, as one teacher put it, go to church every day. His classroom went from 60 pupils in September to just 3 in October. As this was happening, the Sioux were cashing in firewood receipts from the Indian agencies for a third of their value to buy up ammunition, and many were out slaughtering other people's livestock. They were also abandoning their farms in droves at a point when the government was desperately trying to get them off welfare. Indeed, throughout this entire ordeal, the U.S. government continuously gave the Sioux free food, housing, and clothing, as they were literally dancing to their gods to induce white genocide. Attempts to arrest the Sioux bandits were often met with resistance. In one instance, the Indian police from the local Indian agency went to arrest a Sioux by the name of Little, who had been stealing and killing settlers' livestock. But they were surrounded by an angry mob of 200 ghost dancers, who were shouting to kill the lawmen, burn the agency, and take control. However, one Indian in the crowd spoke up in opposition. Quote, "Stop, think, what are you going to do? Kill these men of our own race? Then what? Kill all these helpless white men, women, and children? And what then? What will these brave words, brave deeds, lead to in the end? How long can you hold out? Your country is surrounded with a network of railroads. Thousands of white soldiers will be here within 3 days. What ammunition have you? What provisions? What will become of your families? Think, my brothers. This is a child's madness." Unquote. So in other words, the only thing that restrained them from murdering white women and children was the realization that there would be consequences for doing so. While you're digesting that little tidbit of knowledge, consider that a rancher in the area, James Phillip, stated that a band of Sioux Indians had camped on his property on November 18th. One of the braves, quote, "boasted of the day when he had smashed open the heads of white children and drunk the blood of white women. The time was coming, he vowed, when he would do it again," unquote. On December 19th, a band of Lakota peoples, numbering somewhere around 400 individuals, camped outside the store of a local white man named James Cavanaugh and began doing ghost dances. Eventually, they went into Cavanaugh's store and intimidated him into giving them free provisions. The band's leader, Spotted Elk, aka Bigfoot, had also fought in the Sioux Wars against America a few years prior, so it's hardly surprising that his name had already ended up on a government watch list. Lieutenant Colonel Edwin Sumner of the 8th Cavalry had been ordered to find and keep watch on Bigfoot's band until further notice. Eventually, Sumner was ordered to escort Bigfoot's band to Camp Cheyenne and hold them there. When Sumner confronted Bigfoot, Bigfoot told Sumner that this might cause unrest among his people, and that Sumner should allow Bigfoot's band to return to their home at Cherry Creek. The colonel therefore told Bigfoot that his people could go to their homes and that he himself could remain with them if he promised to come to Camp Cheyenne the next day for a council and to bring all the Standing Rock people with him. Bigfoot gave his promise. Of course, the next day came and went with no word from Bigfoot, who had simply moved on without informing Sumner. After Bigfoot's escape from Cherry Creek, the order was given to arrest him by high command, though Bigfoot's band continued to roam the countryside for some time. Eventually, though, he contracted pneumonia and was intercepted by Major Whiteside of the 7th Cavalry on December 28th. Whiteside told John Changreau, his scout and interpreter, that he wanted Bigfoot's people to hand over their weapons. Changreau advised Whiteside against demanding this right then and there, and suggested instead that they head to Wounded Knee Creek, make camp there, and then disarm the band the next morning. Whiteside heeded the advice, and they all set out for Wounded Knee Creek. Now, to highlight the absolute absurdity that the 7th Cavalry had any hostile intent, Major Whiteside saw how sick Bigfoot was and had him transferred to an army ambulance wagon, and then attended to by one of his own physicians. Later, once camp had been made, the Sioux chief was also given a wood stove and a special tent along with round-the-clock care. The next day, word was given for everyone to assemble in the center of the camp. They were told to hand over their weapons, and the Indians were allowed to deliberate privately. Bigfoot told his people to only hand over their broken weapons. It had been noted by everyone the day prior that the Sioux were well armed with Winchester repeaters, so when they handed over a few broken carbines, Whiteside knew Bigfoot was up to no good. Whiteside told his interpreter, quote, "You tell Bigfoot that he tells me that his Indians have no arms when yesterday at the time of surrender they were well armed. I am sure he is deceiving me," unquote. Bigfoot replied, quote, "They have no guns, only such as you have found. I gathered up all my guns at the Cheyenne River Agency and turned them in, and they were all burned up," unquote. The order was then given for the officers to search the camp. As piles and piles of weapons began to turn up, it became apparent that the women were active participants in deceiving the 7th Cavalry as well. They tried to hide the rifles by placing them under their skirts and sitting on top of them. During all this, Yellowbird, the group's medicine man, was wandering about the camp telling his fellow Sioux in their native language, quote, "Do not be afraid and let your hearts be strong to meet what is before you. We are all well aware that there are lots of soldiers about us and they have lots of bullets, but I have received assurance that their bullets cannot penetrate us. The prairie is large and the bullets will not go towards you. They will not penetrate you," unquote. Here's part of James Mooney's official report compiled a year after the incident, explaining, essentially, what happened next. Quote, "While the soldiers had been looking for the guns, Yellowbird, a medicine man, had been walking among the warriors, blowing on an eagle bone whistle and urging them to resistance, telling them that the soldiers would become weak and powerless, and that the bullets would be unavailing against the sacred ghost shirts, which nearly every one of the Indians wore. As he spoke in the Sioux language, the officers did not at once realize the dangerous drift of his talk, and the climax came too quickly for them to interfere. It is said one of the searchers now attempted to raise the blanket of a warrior. Suddenly, Yellowbird stooped down and threw a handful of dust into the air when, as if this were the signal, a young Indian, said to have been Black Fox from Cheyenne River, drew a rifle from under his blanket and fired at the soldiers, who instantly replied with a volley directly into the crowd of warriors, and so near that their guns were almost touching. From the number of sticks set by the Indians to mark where the dead fell, as seen by the author a year later, this one volley must have killed nearly half the warriors. The survivors sprang to their feet, throwing their blankets from their shoulders as they rose, and for a few minutes there was a terrible hand-to-hand struggle where every man's thought was the kill. Although many of the warriors had no guns, nearly all had revolvers and knives in their belts under their blankets. together with some of the murderous war clubs still carried by the Sioux. The very lack of guns made the fight more bloody, as it brought the combatants to closer quarters. Unquote. After this initial exchange, the fighting became very intense. Robert Utley's description is quite detailed and pulls from multiple sources, many more so than James Mooney. The end result was some 39 US soldiers killed, and depending on which sources you cite, anywhere from 146 to over 300 Indians killed. William Payano, however, a member of the burial party and half Sioux himself, recorded 102 men and women of adult age, 24 old men, 7 old women, 6 boys between 5 and 8 years old, and 7 babies under 2. That's far fewer than the purported 300 plus that some people like to claim. Now, were women and children killed? Yes, but not intentionally, and this needs to be stressed. A lot of women and children were simply killed unintentionally by both sides in the crossfire. Indian men were firing into groupings of US soldiers dispersed within the Indian camp, and the Sioux, all throughout the battle, continued to fire on US troops while still among their own women and children, thereby forcing the 7th Cavalry to return fire. Moreover, there are accounts of women outright engaging in the fighting. One old woman shot at soldiers on horseback and was even allowed to continue firing without retaliation as she fled the battle. Another crawled out from her teepee with a knife and stabbed a wounded American in the chest who lay incapacitated on the ground. To illustrate just how vicious the fighting was, a priest who had been friends with the Indians was stabbed in the back, and a reporter who had come to document the event was forced to fire on the Indians as well, who tried to kill him. As for the infamous usage of Hotchkiss guns that fired into the teepees, well, you can blame that on Indians firing from inside the teepees. This includes Yellowbird, who had helped instigate the entire mess. The fact is, had the Sioux simply handed over their weapons, none of this would have happened, and they probably wouldn't have been asked to hand over their weapons had they not been robbing white settlers. Now, while I do retain some sympathy for the Plains Indians during westward expansion, the idea that they never brought hostility on themselves is absurd. These were not reasonable, peaceful peoples. These were hunter-gatherers whose entire identity centered on warfare and conflict. Okay, so let's get back to BioShock Infinite. To refresh your memory, Booker DeWitt and Elizabeth were led into the Wounded Knee Museum exhibit by Cornelius Slate so that DeWitt could kill a bunch of American veterans of Wounded Knee. The stated purpose was that Slate wanted his men to have a good death, whatever that means. And now that we've killed these veterans, Slate wants us to move on to the Boxer Rebellion exhibit, where undoubtedly the game will repeat the same process. Upon entering that exhibit, Slate addresses us again over the intercom system.
What is this?
It's the Boxer Rebellion.
What happened there?
In Peking, it was my hand that put the city to the torch. Of course. That's not how Comstock tells it.
First off, Americans never set fire to Peking. Actually, it was the Boxers, or the Iho Chuan, who set fire to Peking in June of 1900. As stated in Diana Preston's book on the matter, quote, on June 16th, Boxers attacked the richest trading quarter of the Chinese city, setting fire to all the shops that sold foreign goods. Over 4,000 stores, goldsmiths, jewelers, and furrers, fan, silk, lantern, and curio shops were incinerated as the flames swept northward, unquote.
Accept no low-quality foreign-made substitutes.
Now, leading up to this, the Boxers had also been wandering the countryside murdering hundreds of European missionaries and thousands of Chinese converts, who were seen as traitors to traditional Chinese culture. By mid-May 1900, quote, reports reached the French legation that some 60 Chinese Catholic men, women, and children had been slaughtered at Kaolo, a village some 90 miles from Peking. The bodies had been thrown down a well, and the whole village destroyed, unquote. You see, foreigners and Christians were blamed for a series of natural disasters that had unfortunately befallen China. As Diana Preston states on page 24 of her book on the Boxer Rebellion, quote, Shantung had also been racked by successive floods and droughts. In 1894, the Great Yellow River, China's sorrow, overflowed its banks, flooding 2,500 square miles of country and destroying 1,500 villages. Plagues of locusts and bitter drought followed. Such economic and natural disasters made the province a fertile recruiting ground for the Boxers, who blamed foreign interference and the Christian converts for alienating China's traditional gods, in causing them to punish the land and its people, unquote. The Boxers attributed the peculiar smell of Europeans to the drinking of menstrual blood and, quote, that missionaries used such blood to keep Boxers away, unquote. Others claimed that, quote, foreigners required human eyeballs, particularly children's eyes, for their photographic work and stored them in jars, unquote. The Boxers also believed that a combination of, quote, deep breathing exercises, magical formulas, and the swallowing of charms made their bodies invulnerable to bullets, unquote. Now, American troops were involved in the Boxer rebellions, but in reality were part of a much larger international force called the Eight Nation Alliance, which was comprised of Germany, Japan, Russia, Britain, France, Italy, and Austria-Hungary. Oddly enough, most of the troops came from Japan, not America. Yet Bioshock Infinite makes it seem like fringe American extremists were the only ones involved. As the game's wiki states, quote, in 1901, during the Boxer Rebellion, where American hostages had been taken, Colombian forces intervened without orders from the U.S. government and destroyed the city of Peking. The destruction of the city caused the death of untold Chinese civilians and demonstrated the danger that Colombia posed to the rest of the world, unquote.
Streets closed for your safety, fella. They're prepping tonight's fireworks back there.
There's enough TNT back there to blow Peking to kingdom come. Again.
Again, though, no one blew up Peking, and European forces didn't massacre thousands of innocent civilians. Had they blown up the city, that would have killed the hostages, who, if we're honest, weren't really hostages, but rather besieged ministers and civilians representing several nationalities, trying to survive a nativist uprising intent on exterminating them. As things began to spiral out of control in June of 1900, the Boxers began burning down parts of the city. This included the Nantang and Toontang cathedrals. An initial detachment of American Marines that was already stationed in Peking when this all began to happen managed to save some 300 Chinese converts. Diana Preston quotes in her book two witnesses who said that the rescuers came across some quite appalling sights. Quote, women and children hacked to pieces, men trussed like fowls, with noses and ears cut off and eyes gouged out. Many were found roasted alive and so massacred and cut up as to be unrecognizable, unquote. Eventually, somewhere around 3,000 Chinese converts took up refuge inside the legation quarter, which was basically a small section of Peking that had been set aside for foreign legations, known today as embassies. During the nativist uprising, the Empress Dowager and the Imperial Court eventually sided with the Boxers on June 20th, and then told the foreigners in Peking to leave, but this was essentially a death sentence. The Chinese offered no military escort through the hundreds of miles of hostile countryside to the coast. The mail delivery service wasn't functioning at this point, the telegraph lines had been cut, and there was no operational railway. The Japanese minister had been killed by Boxers outside his own legation, and the German minister was just murdered by Imperial troops. Luckily, however, word had already been sent to the outside world just before communications were cut, and a rescue attempt was underway. Thus ensued a siege lasting almost 2 months, wherein the Boxers and Imperial troops repeatedly tried to breach the legation quarter, the Peitang Cathedral, and the foreign settlement at Tianjin. In the Tianjin settlement alone, 170,000 artillery shells were dropped. As the Boxers began destroying railroad lines in an attempt to impede the rescue parties, they also dug mines under the besieged buildings in an attempt to blow them up. One explosion alone killed over 50 Chinese children under the care of the Catholic missionaries at the Peitang Cathedral. Managed by Bishop Favier, the cathedral was responsible for 3,420 individuals, two-thirds of whom were women and children. Most were Chinese converts, and about 71 were Europeans. The defense force was absurdly small, 30 French and a dozen Italian Marines sent over by their respective ministers. On June 26, quote, Favier wrote that the Boxers had set fire to all the houses adjoining the compound and were placing ladders and scaffolding against the imperial city walls so as to be able to shoot more conveniently. Earlier that day, Bishop Favier thought he could make out Prince Tuan, the Empress, and other high personages, who had come to look on the bombardment as upon a display of fireworks. The incensed Marines wanted to fire on the group, but Favier dissuaded them from such a provocative act in order to not excite an already too violent hatred, unquote. Now, Bishop Favier's desire to avoid provocative acts was indeed a curious notion here, because each time Bishop Favier asked a volunteer to attempt to break through the lines to communicate with the Legation Quarter, the Boxers and Imperial troops captured, tortured, and then decapitated the messenger and placed their head and entrails in front of the church for everyone to see. Moreover, in the Legation Quarter, on June 23rd, the Boxers even set fire to the Han Lin in order to try to burn out the British Legation, which was adjacent to it. Essentially being the Sorbonne and Oxford rolled into one, the Han Lin housed all sorts of priceless Chinese relics and manuscripts dating back over 500 years. Now, considering just how nationalistic the Boxer Rebellion movement was, this should serve as a good metric for gauging just how much the Chinese really wanted to murder all the Europeans, who themselves were ironically mortified by the act, since they seemed to have valued the historical contents more than the native Chinese did. As Diana Preston writes, again, quote, "Scholars among the foreign community were close to tears as they picked amongst the debris. Morrison was furious and blamed the Chinese, writing that the combustible books, the most valuable in the empire, were thrown in a great heap into the pond round the summer house. A heap of debris, timber and ashes sprinkled with torn leaves, marked the site of the great library of the Middle Kingdom. What can we think of a nation that sacrifices its most sacred edifice, the pride and glory of its country and learned men for hundreds of years, in order to be revenged upon foreigners? It was a glorious blaze. The desecration was appalling. Some books and manuscripts were salvaged, and Sir Claude offered them to the Tsung Li Yamen. There was no reply." Unquote. Now, it's truly hard to fathom, but yes, the European legations were trying to hand over priceless historical Chinese relics that they saved from the very fire the Chinese had set. Consider, moreover, that when the legations tried to put out the fire, Imperial troops were shooting at them. Eventually, after a small initial relief force led by Sir Edward Seymour failed to reach Peking via train due to heavy resistance along the rail lines, which the Boxers were sabotaging, he and his men had to fight their way back to the settlement at Tianjin. Later, once Tianjin was secured with reinforcements by sea, a much larger relief force was assembled to march on Peking and liberate the Europeans and the Chinese converts. This much larger force consisted of somewhere around 20,000 men. About half were Japanese. The rest were comprised of some 3,000 Russians, 3,000 British, 2,200 Americans, and 800 Frenchmen. And since the railways had become largely inoperable, these men had to walk to Peking on foot and employ a combination of mules and junks on the river to transport supplies. On August 14th, the Allied forces finally broke through Peking's defenses and liberated the besieged Europeans and Chinese Christians. 2 days later, the Peitang Cathedral was also liberated. Now, it is true that the legation forces looted Peking after breaking the siege. But again, the city wasn't blown up, and American troops never massacred thousands of Chinese civilians who weren't active combatants. In terms of looting in response to ethnic and racial slights, consider that in 2020, black people looted and rioted across several American cities, resulting in billions of dollars in damages, and the justification was that a single man died in police custody due to complications with fentanyl use after he resisted arrest. If, in the minds of some individuals, the George Floyd riots were justified, then consider that in the summer of 1900, Chinese Boxers murdered 136 Protestant missionaries and 53 children. Catholics suffered in similar proportions, with 47 priests and nuns being killed. In addition, more than 1,000 Western and Japanese soldiers were killed, saving the 500 or so women and children of theirs trapped inside the legation quarter. Now, some apologists criticized the large indemnities China was forced to pay to the Allies, somewhere around £67,500,000, or about $335 million at the rate of exchange in 1900, which was set to be paid over the next 40 years. However, in the end, China never paid anywhere near that amount. After the end of World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution, Russia, Germany, and Austria's remaining shares were effectively canceled. The French and British governments eventually decided to stipulate that their shares be spent on various infrastructure within China. Interestingly, America had protested the original amount presented to China at the signing of the Boxer Protocols Treaty in 1901. Essentially, our government asked the other powers to reduce the total by a third, but as things ended up, China agreed to pay the full amount, and so in 1908, America had a surplus above and beyond the original amount we had asked China to pay. Eventually, Theodore Roosevelt decided to return America's excess share to China. One of the forms in which the money was returned was via the establishment of the Boxer Indemnity Scholarship Program, wherein Chinese students were brought to America to study Western science and medicine. Now, looking back, such an act seems somewhat comical, considering how China has since used such programs to steal intellectual property from the West on a regular basis. Now, in general, I do think if China wants to expel foreigners and reject foreign influence in their nation, then we should respect that. But I don't think it would have been reasonable for us to sit by and let our people get massacred. Moreover, the Chinese today generally don't respect our sovereignty any more than we respected theirs. The sad reality of humanity seems to be that sovereignty is only respected when it's backed by strength. Consider here that Chinese media regularly uses critical race theory and adjacent anti-white paradigms in its political and social outreach to acquire more power and influence over traditionally white nations.
Unfortunately, most children's books and shows center around white characters.
If you come from Africa country, you can't go in our building.
This sign at a McDonald's in China said black people are not allowed to enter.
What's China thinking? What's Australia thinking?
From China's perspective, it sees itself as a great power that it can throw its weight around. And Australia is only a middle power. So Australia should be basically more considerate of China's interests.
Respectful even?
Yeah, that's right.
Now, to get us back on track with Bioshock Infinite, the game doesn't really flesh out what Wounded Knee and the Boxer Rebellions were. Rather, it capitalizes on the audience already having a vague notion that these were forms of white people oppressing non-white people, even if they don't know all the details, which is why I've shared some of the details to illustrate that these events were far more nuanced and much less one-sided than postmodernists would have you all believe. Again, Ken Levine didn't establish these memes on his own, but he did carefully assemble them into an exceedingly anti-white narrative. Toward the end of the Boxer Rebellion display, we're met by another George Washington automaton that recites something about how the slanted-eyed Chinese were met with the holy wrath of Father Comstock. Again, the game is reducing these events to an absurdly one-sided form of mo-white racism. Please do consider here that today, instead of the yellow peril, we have the white racist peril.
White supremacy is terrorism.
From here, we progress to a giant room with a bunch of Chinese figurines all storming in the direction of Columbia, which Comstock has dispatched to Peking to free American hostages. A rendition of the beautiful goddess Libertas, or Lady Columbia, is seen in the backdrop. Comstock's propaganda thus depicts the Boxers as the very foreign hordes threatening America, and thus Comstock saw himself as acting in self-defense when he blew up their city. Slate complains again that Comstock is stealing his valor. We then murder more American veterans, and then DeWitt pleads with Slate to stop his insanity.
You did them a favor, Booker. You let them die like men.
I didn't ask for this. I have no quarrel with these men.
Heroes never ask.
I never claim to be no hero.
Then what are you? If you take away all the parts of Booker DeWitt you tried to erase, what's left? Come back to the rotunda. It's almost over.
What did Slate mean? What did you try to erase?
Now that you're out of yours, you might realize cages have their advantages.
A choice is better than none, Mr. DeWitt. No matter what the outcome.
Yeah. What if you woke up one day and realized you didn't like what you chose?
This is more signaling that DeWitt is no different than the other villains we've met and dispatched. Exiting this exhibit, Slate tells us to meet him at the First Lady's memorial. Inside, we come to a figure of Lady Comstock in a horse-drawn chariot holding a baby.
The seed of the prophet lay in the womb of Our Lady but for a single week. Comstock had a child. My books never mention anything about a child.
That's quite an omission. Can't imagine that was by accident.
But the child took ill, and Our Lady prayed for the prophet's heir day and night.
This scene preps us for Elizabeth's great surprise at what we learn in the next room.
That's my tower.
Lo, while Daisy Fitzroy has murdered my beloved, she shall not have the child. She shall not come betwixt her and prophecy.
The seed of the prophet shall sit the throne and drown in flame the mountains of man.
You're Comstock's daughter.
No, I can't be. I can't.
He wants you to follow in his footsteps.
Well, I want a puppy, but that doesn't mean I'm gonna get one.
So, we now know that Elizabeth is meant to fulfill Comstock's prophecy and drown in flames the mountains of man. In the next room, we're given Comstock's rendition of events regarding the murder of Lady Comstock. The culprit, according to him, was the anarchist Daisy Fitzroy. But now that Slate and the preceding levels of Wounded Knee and the Boxer Rebellion have shown us that all of America is a giant lie, we know better than to trust what the evil white supremacist says. When we exit into a nearby courtyard of sorts, a gate impedes our progress forward.
Let me scout ahead, see if there's some way to move forward. Look!
Is that?
It's a tear, something I can bring into this world.
It's a freight hook. Well, that's convenient.
As I said, it's a form of wish fulfillment.
Elizabeth's comment about her abilities being a form of wish fulfillment is not a coincidence or a throwaway concept. It actually ties into how the narrative blames her as much as it blames DeWitt for all the suffering that has occurred. But we will get more into that later. For now, we simply have to gun down more American patriots in the Hall of Heroes. After that, we enter a souvenir shop.
To the sky, Comstock bent his knee and saw with holy prophecy. And too rare is the man who takes the stand. You and God and sweetest fatherland. Was here on the face they be revered. The heroes of our city lie.
That's what Comstock will turn us into. Wires and gears to replace heads and hearts!
Booker!
The Lord judges, I act.
Elizabeth covers her ears in anguish as all the patriotic poems get recited, and then you battle a Gatling gun-wielding automaton of George Washington. The messaging here is painfully obvious at this point. Patriotism is cringe and evil. Of course, there's a double entendre here as well. The George Washington automaton was what Slate was referring to when he said that they'd all be turned into tin. Comstock is going to replace them all with these automatons. Again, I have to ask why Comstock and Fink would import Negro convicts and Orientals to do menial labor when they had automated soldiers. I mean, if it can hold a gun, it can hold a mop. So, in case you don't remember why we're in the Hall of Heroes, it's to find that shock jockey vigor so that you can start the gondola to get to the First Lady airship. But, surprise, surprise, it's not here in the Hall of Heroes, but Slate does have it, and you have to return to the courtyard to find him. After murdering yet another horde of American patriots, you find another voxophone nearby.
My men and I are doomed. Doomed as noble Custer was at Little Bighorn. But we shall not yield to Comstock and his tin soldiers. But my scout has seen him. Booker DeWitt is coming here to the hall. DeWitt. We called him the White Engine of Wounded Knee for all the grisly trophies he claimed. A man such as he might just grant us the peace we seek.
Now, calling DeWitt the White Engine of Wounded Knee is somewhat amusing because it inadvertently alludes to the reality that the engines were far more hostile, violent, and savage in their warfare than Europeans were. Of course, that's not what Ken Levine wants you to walk away with. You're supposed to conjure up an image of a blood-covered white man wearing an ear necklace while eating the heart out of a dead baby, or something along those lines. Skipping ahead past more tedious combat, we finally confront Slate. He's half dead and demands that we finish him off. Something, something, eat everything on your plate, soldier. Should you choose to kill him, he exclaims that you haven't changed one bit. Again, a reference to how DeWitt, the quintessential white man, can't change his evil ways. Elizabeth says it was probably Mercy since Comstock's men would have gotten to him, and then she asks if you ever get used to all the killing. DeWitt replies, faster than you can imagine. Again, DeWitt is a very bad, bad man.